Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. We are conducting an exclusive interview with Bruce Cowper, top international security authority and a Microsoft chief security advisor. In addition, Bruce is a founding member of one of the largest security user groups, TASC, and a founder of the Sector Security Conference. Bruce, thank you for coming in today to share your deep insights with the audience.
Oh, thanks for inviting me along.
Bruce, as Chief Security Advisor, can you provide an overview of how your work relates to these areas, such as security governance or defense in depth, virus protection, malware removal, corporate espionage, and other security topics, and Microsoft security products such as Forefront or security solution accelerators?
So my role essentially encompasses three big areas. The first one is I'm the liaison between the Canadian government and Microsoft from a security perspective. And so that means that I spend lots of time understanding or helping to understand the requirements that the government are putting in place with some of their governance mechanisms like and standards like MITS and others. Also looking at how I can provide input from, say, the learnings we have within the private sector work that I do, and the learnings from literally being out in the community within Canada. And so I basically provide essentially a two-way conversation. The second thing is that a big part of my role is education and awareness around security. And that's not necessarily just from the Microsoft sort of product and sort of strategy angle, but also works very much as a citizenship component. So, for example, I do a lot of work in schools, community groups, and others. Even talking to kids and parents around things like online safety, identity theft, cyberbullying, and challenges like that that are particularly prevalent within Canada today. The last part is that I spend an awful lot of time within the community, as you mentioned, with things like TASC and Sector. And to be perfectly honest, I think that they fall very much all into the sort of the areas that you discussed. So, for example, the security governance. One of the areas that I'm very much involved with is, for example, C27 and some of the other standards that are being implemented within the Canadian government to help people understand what is actually needed in terms of governance, and not just from, say, the Microsoft perspective, but how we look at what is achievable from a technology standpoint. What would be ideal from, say, a security and privacy standpoint, and what we can really start to do to think about even things like legislation within Canada and how it impacts both businesses and individuals within Canada, predominantly to make Canada not only a nice place to live, but also a great place to do business, so that we essentially are able to expand our sort of worldwide presence. Now, a huge part of that for me is things like defense in depth, because as you can imagine, a lot of the threats or the perceived threats out there are to do with things like malicious software, viruses, the sort of the insider threat, corporate espionage, etc. And one of the big roles that I have is, on the one hand, almost trying to dispel some of the myths. For example, recent research has shown that whilst there's been an increase in Canada in the first half of 2008 of nearly 40% in terms of the amount of malware, so things like Trojans, viruses, even adware on people's computers, we've seen essentially a shift in terms of where a lot of the security breaches are actually occurring. And so, for example, during that same time period, nearly 50% of all the security breaches that were reported came from lost or stolen devices. And so that's really important to Canadians when we think about sort of how we approach both personal security, safety, and privacy online, or whether we're talking about, say, large banks or even the government, where we understand essentially where the threats are coming from and essentially the things that we may need to do to deal with, whether that's from a policy angle or whether that's from a technology angle or essentially sort of both, to really understand how we need to try and address some of those threats.
So my audience is really global, and a significant portion in Europe and the Latin America areas and Asia and so on. In terms of, some of the things that you talked about in Canada, I would assume that many of those also apply globally.
Very much so. In fact, we've certainly seen a lot of the information that I look at in Canada. I also get the global information form. We've certainly seen much the same trends. Now, different countries have different approaches, and from some of the telemetry, we're able to apply. For example, Spain recently has seen perhaps a bigger upswing in terms of malicious software, et cetera, than some other countries in the world because they've now got broadband internet access that's proliferating across the country. And so that's already a challenge that Canada has been through. And so what we can do is look to applying some of the learnings that we've had here on a sort of an international stage. So whilst essentially Canada is a lot of my focus, I think you're absolutely right in saying that a lot of the same lessons can be applied. And one of the opportunities that we have is to take the lessons from countries like Canada and the UK and elsewhere, where we may have been through some of these challenges, to essentially help countries and organizations around the world bypass some of that learning curve.
Okay, Bruce, let's now focus on security governance and strategy in more detail. So, what can you say about security governance challenges, best practices, and solutions?
Well, one of the big things that's occurred that we're seeing is with the economic downturn, is how people look at things like security and privacy and governance. And so a couple of good examples of that. We're seeing a lot of organizations almost making security, privacy, and governance coalesce within their organizations, whether that's by physically amalgamating departments or whether that's by taking very much a more holistic approach. And I'll give you a good example. Now, a lot of organizations, say, for example, financial services, where you may have more essentially controls in place within those organizations, they may also have greater budgets. So you can imagine that they would go to an awful lot greater depths with things like security governance. One of the things that we're doing is looking at how we can take the learnings from them out to different organizations. And part of that is that a lot of organizations will say, well, you know what, especially in an economic downturn, it's really hard for us to essentially understand where we're going to apply and sort of justify things like security technologies. So the flip that we're really seeing is a lot of organizations looking at governance and saying, well, within my organizational, within my industry, these are the big things that I have to worry about. Perhaps it's privacy of customers' information and data, and some of the potential ramifications if there is a data breach, whether it be things like Sarbanes-Oxley, C-198 in Canada, and all sorts of privacy regulations elsewhere. And so there's the governance layer there to understand what are the particular challenges that my business is going to face. They have made, and sort of the policies and the processes they put in place. And to say almost how are we achieving governance, or what are the small deltas that we need to do to achieve governance by essentially leveraging better the investments that we've already made within our organization. And a couple of, I think, particularly pertinent examples of that is where I see companies implementing things like technology. Most of the technology they're implementing is not just straightforward, here's a security point-in-time solution. What they're looking for is, okay, well, here's a security solution to help me deal with a particular challenge that I may have or that I perceive, a particular threat. Then looking at how do I provide information on things like when that threat has become a reality or if there's an issue or how do I know that I'm safer and that threat isn't a problem to my organization now? And then really providing things like the reporting functionality so that they can, when they look back at their sort of governance, that they're then looking at that and saying, and compliancy, and they're looking at that and saying, okay, now that I put in place to deal with some of the threats that are out there, and I get things like the telemetry, that helps me understand my current state and when things have gone wrong, what went wrong, how do we fix it, how do we avoid that happening again in the future. And so governance really comes very much into that. But I'm seeing a lot of organizations, as I say, flipping it on its head rather than saying governance for almost the sake of governance. I'm seeing a lot of organizations saying, well, how do we achieve governance and compliancy with a lot of the investments that we're making?
So taking that sort of same area where we talked about security governance challenges and best practices and solutions, can you extend this to strategy?
Very much so. When we start to think about how do we achieve things like compliance and how do we sort of control essentially what's happening with the governance, the strategy becomes essentially the means to getting the job done. Now, when we, in the sort of the previous example, we've seen a lot of organizations really start to look at, as part of their strategy, working with, for example, vendors and other organizations to help them get to the point where and get the input to say, okay, well, I understand perhaps better where I am. How do we actually get to things like a secure, well-managed environment? How do we achieve things like defense in depth? And that's actually part of the job that I do, is to help organizations think about their strategy as they move forward. And especially these days, where budgets are tighter. So when we think about that, a lot of the strategy now includes subtopics, including sort of areas like interoperability, even green IT. So in other words, things like savings around, rather than sort of implementing an awful lot of firewalling, for example, or awful lot of new machines or new technology, how do I achieve that through even topics like virtualization? And so what we see, with standards also become a very big part of the same conversation. And so the strategy component that I'm seeing a lot of organizations do involves reaching out to vendors, to partners, and even the community to be able to ask, so what did you do? How did you do it? What were the challenges that were solved, as it were, and what were the learnings that you have, so that I can essentially have a more effective strategy moving forward?
And you talked earlier about defense in depth. Can you give us just a little bit more sort of an overview of what that means?
Sure. So when we look at things like security, the traditional view has been one of point-in-time solutions in many cases. So, for example, the perimeter of my network, I have a firewall. So that's essentially a point-in-time solution designed to protect me against external threats. Internally, I may have things like junk mail filters, email filtering, antivirus programs, anti-spyware programs. I may implement policies to do with acceptable use on the infrastructure that I put in place. I may implement things like server isolation or other point-in-time solutions. What we're finding is a lot of organizations who have gone down that path are now starting to want to tie them together. So when we look at things like understanding if a problem has occurred within my organization, so say a virus gets onto somebody's PC, or there's a piece of malicious software or an insider threat, it's really important for us not just to look at the point-in-time solutions and perhaps even the telemetry that they provide, but to take a much more holistic view. So, for example, if we're talking about a virus coming in on an email, which is still a reasonable threat these days, so the industry is certainly getting better. Defense in depth would essentially say, well, how about taking a look at that particular threat even before it comes into my organization? So how about let's maybe even use a third party or another virus scanning junk mail filter system outside the perimeter of my network. So in other words, offloading an awful lot of the load, as it were, onto that was originally been within the network, And also, if you can block it before it comes into the network, so much the better. Then, of course, we got the perimeter of our network and saying, well, okay, that we don't want to just have any content or any particular email coming from perhaps unknown sources. So I may do things like validating of where that email has come from before I allow it into my network. Then, of course, I'm likely to do things like junk mail filtering and virus scanning and even content filtering within my network even before it gets to the user. So a traditional thing of an email coming in might have multiple layers of defenses. The next part of that is to understand that that email going onto the person's computer, well, we perhaps want local resources to be able to try and defeat perhaps any malicious code it may contain. And so we have defenses not just on the network itself, but also then on the computer. Take it to the next level. What happens if that computer is infected with a piece of malicious software and is now no longer compliant with our, say, corporate policy? So then how about isolating that computer from the network, then being able to notify the security team that there is essentially a security breach, but that it's been contained because the machine has now been isolated from the network? A good example of that is something like Conficker right now has three modes of attack. The first one is that it's trying to propagate itself using perhaps known vulnerabilities in people's machines. So if you've done your patch management, that's essentially a defense against the first attack. The second one is as it looks at attacking other machines, it will try and essentially guess things like passwords, easy to guess usernames and passwords and sort of shared folders, that sort of thing. So, of course, if you've taken the approach in your organization of making sure you have strong passwords, that your machines aren't sharing resources they don't need to share, i.e. they're not publishing directories and things like that, again, that's a bigger defense against that component or that attack vector. The third one is it looks for things like USB and other storage devices. So, of course, if your organization has said as part of your defense-in-depth approach, I'm only going to allow certain types of USB-type devices. I don't want MP3 players or cell phones or photo frames or other storage devices connected. I'm only going to allow certain types. That's part of your defense-in-depth strategy that may actually defeat that type of that attack vector. But, of course, the last part of that is things like the remediation. How do I understand when there's a problem that's happening internally and then have a mechanism whether automated or manual to deal with it. And so that becomes all the defense in depth of everything from even before the perimeter of the network, through the perimeter, onto the services that are being provided within the network, whether it's email, SharePoint, whatever it happens to be, then onto the desktop, then all the reporting and compliancy behind the scenes to really be able to have multiple layers of defense to deal with threats.
So that's quite an extensive sort of strategy that sort of has overlapping layers in a sense too in it. Sort of maybe almost like a holistic view, would you say that?
Very much so. I mean, what we're trying to do is get people to step away from the point in time and also the reliance on technology, and understand that it is very much a holistic view around technology, compliancy, policy, and strategy within your organization.
You know, security is such a big area. Do you have added best practices to share on the areas we talked about earlier and others?
Well, actually, I think a lot of the best practices are coming out of the industry themselves. So when we start to talk around things like virus protection, an awful lot of the strategies around that are very much defense in depth. So I mentioned the email coming through the system and how you would deal with the threat associated with that. But there are also other areas to consider, like mobile devices or devices that are not directly controlled by the corporate environment. And so when you're talking about, say, viruses and malicious software, there generally are a number of sort of key or fundamental points to look for. Certainly number one is making sure that your machines are up to date, and not just the operating systems, but all of the applications that are contained within there. The reason I say that is because we've seen a big shift in terms of attacks leveled against the operating systems, more towards the application layer and the users themselves. We've all heard of things like phishing and other types of social engineering type attacks. And so defense in depth is really sort of govern it sort of helps from that perspective. And keeping your machines up to date is certainly a big sort of step in the right direction. As I mentioned with Konfica, one of the big things was applying the patch, the MS-069 patch, to your system. The next part of that is going through and understanding things like the assets that you have. Because we find in many instances, organizations will overlook perhaps vulnerable systems because they don't necessarily understand, A, where that system sits within the network or the infrastructure, or B, the implications perhaps of that particular machine or service or being compromised. Good example of that is we've seen a lot of VoIP servers over the years that are perhaps that's a voice over IP where the servers themselves are perhaps using older technology, like older operating systems, and of course they're a black box that's sitting in the corner, not connected to the network. Sorry, connected to the network, but not managed in the same way that you would with the rest of the services on, and servers on your network. And so therefore, maybe they become more vulnerable to, and especially with, say, older operating systems, etc., and older applications, more vulnerable to attack. And so understanding the assets that you have is incredibly important for that. Next is then looking at what are the threats within my organization. And bearing in mind that when we talk about viruses and malware especially, a lot of the attacks ultimately emanate internally, because of either a user perhaps opening an email, clicking on a link, going to a social networking site that contains malicious software, whatever it happens to be. And so having things like layered defenses, user account control was a good example when it first sort of came out, that people used to get a lot of pop-ups saying, "This is happening on your system." Now that's useful for us to understand, yes, these are a lot of things that are happening on my system that I should be aware of. But the challenge, of course, is you provide users with too much information, it becomes very confusing for them. It becomes often confusing for us as security professionals. So it becomes a good balance of the controls that we put in place, say, at the user end, and the amount of control that we give them through things like education and awareness. In fact, the education and awareness is, I think, a huge component that is often overlooked within a lot of organizations. So I was reading not so long ago a study by Deloitte & Touche, Worldwide Security Survey that they do every year. And one of the findings was that a lot of organizations didn't provide training to some of their most essentially vulnerable staff, and that with their people like receptionists or other areas where you may get a turnover of staff, where on a regular basis you would have to provide things like training, awareness, and education for them, even before you get to people who have access to perhaps sort of more sensitive information or systems. And so I think that is sort of a very big part that does need to be addressed within most organizations.
I guess that sort of speaks to then the need for policies and processes and procedures and so on within the organization itself, in conjunction with the technologies and so on.
I agree with that. I mean, when I was doing security auditing before I joined Microsoft, one of the first things I'd do when I walked into an organization would be to say, "Can I have a look at your policy around things like online access or email or other areas? Your documentation and your sort of procedures on things like what to do in the event of." And the vast majority of organizations that I walked into generally would have either no documentation or very limited documentation. Or if they did have comprehensive documentation, in many cases, it was way too complex for the average user to go back and understand. And so I think that being able to articulate, sort of being able to put in your own plans, strategies, policies, and procedures, for example, is certainly one thing. But translating them into a mechanism that can actually be used is another. And certainly another sort of big area is then testing those policies and procedures. So many instances that I would go into, and I've seen even recently, organizations saying, well, we have a security breach, and when we actually went to deal with that security breach, well, we realized that our policies and procedures were somewhat lacking because we'd never really had to test them in this way before. And so I find that that component is often sort of very much overlooked by organizations.
So what do you think is the greatest source then for information and also for support in terms of security-related issues? Is it vendor sites, or is it the community? Is it working with groups like TASC or attending conferences? What are your views on this? And I guess what I'm trying to connect in is your impetus behind your work with TASC and Sector as well.
I think you sort of hit the nail on the head somewhat in that I believe that a lot of the way that we learn is by connecting through and to others. And I think part of it is, number one, perhaps being able to ask the question in terms of, I've got a problem I need to deal with today. I need to know the people, and I need to know sort of where to go, the resources that are available to me. Number two is perhaps I'm starting to think about where I'm going in the future and my strategies around implementing X. Doesn't matter what it is, but rather than having to go and look at sort of everything myself, being able to go to people and say, so what did you do? What were the experiences that you had, the good, the bad, and the ugly? And the third part of it is also always the career component as to how people move up the stack, as it were. And so for me, fundamentally, the community is the way to all three of those. So you can go to certainly a vendor, and you can get information from the vendor about things like the technologies and their recommended best practices and their recommended procedures. But at the end of the day, it's always good to be able to go to people and sort of get more, perhaps, examples of how they dealt with those particular challenges. So I think that's where the community really starts to come into its own, is essentially a connection point. And it doesn't matter whether it's a local community or a global community, I think it's just as important. And therefore, sort of hence why I put so much of my time and effort into community activities, because I think that that's where people gain the most benefit. In other words, having a safe place to go and ask those questions.
Bruce, you've been in security for such a long time, and you've advised corporations worldwide. You've been a forensic auditor and so on. You've had so many roles within the security area and really on a global basis. Because of that, you've had some really unique insights. Can you provide your predictions of future IT and business security trends and their implications and opportunities?
Sure. There are some really big trends that I'm seeing both at the technology side and also elsewhere. And so when I start to look at some of the big threats that are occurring right now, one of the big areas is still around externally available, say, websites and other resources, where things like input or sort of cross-site scripting or input validation and other areas like that, I'm still seeing as being especially big attack vectors to a lot of organizations. In fact, I noticed a recent series of articles triggered predominantly by SANS coming out and with their top 25 security challenges around especially the development and sort of configuration of websites, where organizations are now looking at that to say, okay, well, should we at least be going to our suppliers and our vendors and saying, are you dealing with these top challenges? And especially around things like the application layer attacks. The next big area that I see as sort of an increasing threat is malicious software. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, in Canada, we've seen an upswing of nearly 40% in terms of the amount of malware that's out there. One of the biggest areas was not necessarily the traditional viruses. It was actually adware, where I'm seeing that a lot of people are almost accepting that attacks for using, say, a free piece of software they've downloaded from the internet is being presented with advertising material or using free services. What they may not understand is that part of the idea behind that is you provide targeted advertising based on things like the websites you may be going to, the types of applications you're using, the information that you're searching for online. And so the big threat around that is, in order to do that, they've got to gather information about you. And so I see it both from a privacy aspect of essentially the abuse of information about me that may be out there, but also from the security aspect of making it a lot easier to target me for things like phishing attacks or other social engineering type attacks. Another big area I see coming up as sort of part of my top 10 for 2009 and beyond is virtualization and the attacks against virtualization. And I think that there's really two big areas to consider here. One is a lot of organizations that I speak to are only really now understanding some of the threats to a virtualized environment, where things like compromise of a host box rather than, say, the guest operating system in a server virtualization environment, by compromise the host box, potentially I've compromised all of the machines that are running on there. And so a lot of organizations will look at the virtual machines themselves and manage and maintain them in the way that they would traditionally a physical machine, but they don't necessarily look below that layer towards the virtualization layer and things like the management tools, the other components of virtualization to understand, well, what are the threats that are aimed at that part of my virtualization strategy. Certainly, as well, we see lots of studies that say that the guest operating system, so in other words, perhaps the machines I'm virtualizing, are perhaps less well secured, less well managed and maintained than their physical counterparts. And especially because we're seeing such an explosion of virtual machines around the world, that becomes a bigger concern. A couple of examples of that are, if I take a guest operating system and I take a snapshot of itself for a, say, backup or disaster recovery purposes, that is now a complete copy of my machine, and so needs to be protected, managed, and maintained in the same way that I would my running virtual machine or my physical machine. The other side of that is that because I'm now talking about file copies rather than physical access, it used to be the case of you got physical access to a machine, you had all access to a machine. Now with virtualization, think about it from the point of view of my physical access is actually now access to my virtual hard disks. And so it's less of an issue now in terms of I don't need to be in the server room. That some of the attacks that were physical can now be thought of as remote attacks. Next one on my list, perhaps number four, is sort of mobile devices. And this really comes from the convergence of technologies. So my cell phone no longer is a cell phone. It has a camera. It has email. It has internet access. It has lots of storage on it. And so all of the different types of mobile devices out there are essentially being used far more by us. Now, that means that we're storing more data on there. The more data that we store on there potentially brings us into risk of, as I said earlier, about 50% of the security breach notifications were through lost or stolen devices, because these devices now have an intrinsic value that's far higher than when it was just a cell phone. I mentioned VoIP-focused attacks earlier, and I think that that's an area where we're going to see not just the VoIP infrastructure becoming attacked, but also things like the data streams themselves. And we're already starting to see a lot of those types of attacks, and that's predominantly because of the value of the information that may be going up and down those VoIP links. social engineering. Even though this isn't a particularly new topic, I'm seeing an awful lot of social engineering attacks that are getting much more sophisticated. We like to think of it in security world as being layer 8, i.e. the users. But essentially, there was a study done recently, and part of one of these perhaps urban legends, but really talking about what value users put on things like usernames, passwords, and data, and understanding some of the threats to that. And so whether it's, for example, one study was suggesting pretty much all of the users they spoke to would give out their username and password in exchange for a candy bar, the value of that becomes sort of your username and password is not just to an organization where potentially information may be compromised, but even just having to do account resets because of a compromised password or somebody concerned about that has an intrinsic value to an organization. The next area, perhaps number 7 on my list, is really around consumer devices. Now, I'm seeing an awful lot of consumer devices coming into enterprise organizations. So these may be things like GPS systems, USB drives, or even photo frames. And people not necessarily understanding that these are potentially attack vectors to an organization, and really from a couple of perspectives. One is there may be data stored on them that is essentially not managed and not controlled by the organization. And the second part is that they have no management of these types of devices, so not being able to update a photo frame or the firmware that's on the photo frame because it has a security vulnerability, or other sort of consumer network devices as well. Number 8 on my list is perhaps insider attacks. And again, this isn't a particularly new area. What I really am seeing is a lot more of the insider attacks, especially as we go into a much tougher economy, with the value of most organizations being in the data that they hold within their networks. And so if the value is there and there's enough will, what we're starting to see is more and more organizations essentially putting the emphasis on protecting the data rather than just protecting the perimeter of the network, because it's, as I mentioned, the data that holds the intrinsic value, the intellectual property, that sort of thing. Number 9 on my list is actually games and gaming consoles. And in a business context, there's perhaps a couple of people out there that be scratching their head saying, well, why should I be worried about those? Well, there's actually a few things. So a good example is I walked into a server room not so long ago, and in the server room, there was an Xbox sitting on a rack. So me thinking that they were hardcore gamers and that they were doing their gaming sort of using the Xbox, started asking them questions. And it turns out that it was the cheapest mechanism that they could find for actually running their DNS server within the organization. And so now you have a consumer device that's a gaming console that they have no ability to manage and maintain that's now connected onto their corporate environment. Beyond that as well, I see a lot of people connecting things like gaming consoles onto their networks for gaming purposes. And of course, these have internet access through the networks. But again, we have no control over them, but they still have the ability to connect to the internet, to share information, to really sort of interact with people beyond the organization. And so from that perspective, I'm seeing a lot more requests from, say, organizations around things like Xbox forensics and other types of attacks leveled against games, whether it's World of Warcraft or whether it's Second Life or others, because there's ultimately financial gain behind it. And the last thing I'd say on my top 10 threats moving forward is actually the number of organizations that are not taking the holistic view towards security and are still taking very much a point-in-time approach towards their security strategies. And the reason I wanted to sort of add that one into the list was very much that in many cases, organizations can really affect things like much better security, but also without having large incremental costs, because every point-in-time solution costs me a lot of money. Whereas if I start taking a much more holistic view towards things like management and control on my network and my systems, and therefore the policies, procedures, and governance that and compliance that goes with it, what I think we'll start to see is those organizations that don't take those types of approaches will be far more vulnerable to attack, and especially as we go into a challenging economic climate worldwide, those essentially become the biggest targets, even if they're not the biggest company.
So you discussed some of these security trends and their implications, and it's just amazing, you know, just sort of the breadth of them all, and you know, I see these vulnerabilities and challenges and solutions as well. So what are your top specific recommended resources and why?
Well, I would say that there are probably three big resources that I would suggest people look for. Number one is really looking towards the community, as we talked about earlier, so that you've got an opportunity to connect with people and ask those questions. So user groups, industry associations, that's within your, not just your local area, but that you may be able to connect with sort of remotely as well. The second big resource that I always use are things like the blogs. Now, it used to be sort of very difficult for me to go around and sort of monitor and keep an eye on all of what everybody's saying, but it's certainly been hugely useful with technologies like Twitter and others, RSS feeds and other ways of essentially joining the data and sort of bringing it to where I can absorb it, and certainly being one of the sort of top resources that we have out there. And I would say that the third big one is, as you start to think about how you essentially within your organization attack, sort of deal with threats, etc., taking not just a holistic view of the technology, but being able to communicate those challenges within your organization becomes an incredibly important set of resources. I've always found that as I go into an organization, maybe it's not the security guy that I want to be speaking to, though you'll have a particular perspective on and particular set of inputs and resources of their own, but also going and speaking to people essentially on the ground floor, ground zero, and understand, well, how do you actually use the systems, or what are the workarounds that you've discovered because of perhaps more draconian security policies, that sort of thing. A great example was I went into an organization that said, well, we don't allow people to email around Word documents to each other. So what users were doing was plugging a USB key and copying the Word document across and sneaker netting that across to the person they wanted to share it with. So bypassing the services and the security that was being put in place. So my third resource is people, and making sure that you connect with the people that are around you, because at the end of the day, especially as a security professional, the last thing that we want to do, especially with IT managers and sort of the management layer, is live in a little silo. Getting the outside perspective is incredibly important.
Chris, do you have any people specifically that our audience could live search and maybe find their blog or some forum where they reside?
Sure. In fact, there are a sort of a specific group of people that I tend to keep an eye on. And they're not necessarily just, say, Microsoft people. They're sort of people, I think, within the industry that are worthwhile paying attention to. So when I think about topics such as privacy, I think immediately of people like Michael Geist. I look at people like Doug Cavett. When I think about sort of pure security in terms of, say, infrastructure, from a management perspective, I look at people like Kai Axford and his blog. I look for Steve Riley. When I'm thinking about the sort of the more esoteric gaming world, there are actually a number of sort of resources that are out there. But one of the things that I've always found really interesting is if I find a person like, say, Doug Cavett, is to go onto his blog and look at the people's blogs that he's recommending. And I often find that there's quite an interesting sort of place, or sort of places within that, that I would have never found without having sort of gone through his blog, perhaps. So certainly, one of the things that I know that Microsoft did was to put together on their website, is microsoft.ca/security, and there's a download of both in English and French, a security roadmap, as it were. And within that document, on the second page, is a whole list of blogs of different teams, of different people to watch. And certainly those I found to be incredibly useful resources because they're people from all over the world.
Well, I think that's an incredible connection point and a sort of a resource list that you just provided, so I really thank you for that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, Bruce, we're coming near to the end of our interview here, and if you were doing this interview, what sort of questions would you ask and what would be your answers?
Actually, I would say that the three big questions that I would probably ask would be, number one is to find out what people do think of when we talk about terms like defense in depth. The reason I say that is because there's quite often essentially a misunderstanding of what that really means. A lot of people think about it just in terms of maybe the technology, and I'd like to get people to sort of almost step back. And so for me, that's very much taking a holistic view, and not just the technology, but people and the processes that are involved in security. The second big question that I like to ask a lot is, what do people think of in terms of the differences even between security and privacy? The reason I ask that question is because I get a lot of people who say to me, well, privacy is essentially keeping my information secure, so my personal private data, making sure that the use of that information is sort of reasonable. And that's fair enough. But what I think a lot of organizations may be overlooking is the end user. Now, in a lot of organizations, we keep privacy and security very much separate. What I'm seeing is if you go and speak to a lot of end users and you say, well, I'm sorry, your information, your personal private data information was leaked onto the internet, for example, they actually don't care whether it's a security issue or if it's a privacy issue. To them, they're actually one in the same thing. They're both. They're two sides of the same coin. What a lot of consumers will then do is turn around and say, well, okay, you obviously haven't taken the right approach to protecting my information and me. You've breached the trust that I have within your organization, and therefore I'm going to vote with my feet rather than say, oh dear, what a shame, what are you going to do to protect me next time? And so I'm always interested to ask what people see as both the differences and maybe even the convergence of security and privacy. The third question that I ask on a regular basis is, ultimately, we're all consumers. And whilst I spend the vast majority of my life working with governments and large enterprise, I always like to bring it back to, so we're all consumers. How do we see and feel that industry is doing with helping protect me when I'm online? Helping protect my family, helping protect my information. And it amazes me that a lot of people, when I speak to them and ask them that question, say, oh, well, you know what, I'm really not sure. I see organizations like big IT companies as being essentially large faceless organizations. Like, I've no idea how to contact Microsoft if I've got a virus on my system. And part of the challenge about organizations like Microsoft and others is how do we communicate out things like, well, there's actually a free tech support line that's global, that if anybody has a problem with their computer from a virus, you've got a mechanism to speak to us and speak to a human and not just go to a website. But I think often the perception is there that people don't know what the don't know about those resources, and perception of maybe companies don't care as much as they should do. And so it's always interesting for me to get people to step back and become the end user and think about the security world in their context.
Well, those are very great series of questions and really informative answers. I was wondering if you can close with maybe a story that you can share that in terms of your travels and the work that you do with enterprises and governments and so on.
Sure. I've got an interesting story. I did an audit for a bank a number of years ago. And the bank had said, I'm very happy for you to come and do a security audit of our services, but I don't want to let the staff know that you're going to do this. And I looked at the bank and had a big discussion with them about the investments that they made in security. And they seemed to have a very significant approach and a huge commitment to their customers and to their staff. When I actually went to the bank and started doing my audit, I walked into a branch. I sat and waited for somebody to come along and type in their PIN code so that I could sort of get access through into their secured area. And there was a lady who walked along not long after that carrying a large box. So I got up, put the PIN number in, held the door open for her. She thanked me profusely. But of course, now I'm walking into the branch of the bank with information, but I'm also walking in with a person that is known. So perhaps then that sort of helps me to be more recognized within the bank. I walk up to a desk, I plug my laptop in and start having a look around. After a very short space of time, I was able to gain access to resources, albeit because I was physically plugged into their network, but without them essentially having some of the controls that I would expect to see in place. And I was able to get access to some fairly sensitive resources. Walked into a board meeting that was going on and presented them with things like a list of usernames and passwords. And it was interesting that there were really a few big outcomes from that. One was the organization completely forgot the social aspect and the essentially the entry points or the sort of physical entry points as being such big threats to their organization. The second thing is they'd actually breached their own security policies by essentially looking or allowing things like easy-to-guess passwords, because people within the senior part of the organization hadn't got buy-in to essentially looking at, to the implementing full security policies because it was hard for them to remember a complex password. And the third thing is they hadn't realized how vulnerable their systems were because they weren't doing regular audits, and that's why I'd been brought in. So it doesn't matter whether you're a home user and you're concerned about keeping your memory safe and secure in terms of the pictures that you take, the movies that you produce, etc., or whether you're a large bank. Security is the challenge of everyone. And it always amuses me every time I go into organizations to go and repeat the same challenges or the same steps that I'd used before to see how many of the old tricks still work.
Well, that's a fascinating story, Bruce, and it really does share a lot of different kinds of insights that, you know, that are very usable by the audience because it, you know, gives them an idea what the vulnerabilities are. So, you know, Bruce, we thank you that you took the time to do this interview, and we will continue to follow your significant contributions. And again, thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thanks very much for inviting me along.
This concludes our exclusive interview with Bruce Cowper, top international security authority and a Microsoft Chief Security Advisor. In addition, Bruce is a founding member of one of the largest security user groups, TASC, and a founder of the Sector Security Conference.